We have a guest speaker with us. Many of you, I'm sure, are as enthralled as I am when we received the email or whatever method you received the some of us for Facebook and so forth, telling us about some blind person or blind event, event involving blind people in history that we didn't know anything about, and then we get a deep dive. And I know that for me, it's some of the, I really look forward to them, and I have to keep myself from sitting down and reading it right there and then, because I might be in the middle of something when I stumble across it. But we're very happy to have with us Peggy Chong, who is the blind history lady, and she's going to be sharing with us tonight. Peggy?
Great. Thank you very much. And Ronza, if you if I talk too long, give me a 2-minute warning, and then I will wind it all down. One of the things that I learned about while I was living in Baltimore a year or two back was this center called Evergreen, and that had something to do with blindness. And so that's always been something I've been trying to find out more about, and I've collected a few things about it. One of the ways, you know, we can always read all the information, and everybody tells you how great their program is and how they got such wonderful results and everything. But did they? The proof is in the pudding. The proof is not how much money they got or who sits on their board or what their students were doing 6 months after they graduated, but what their graduates were doing 2 years, 5 years, 6 years afterwards. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about the Evergreen program, and then I'm going to tell you about some of the graduates of that program. And I have to flip over to another screen. There we go. I've had a little trouble with my computer lately, and I don't want to take it in because I'm afraid somebody will get COVID-19 and I won't get it back. Anyway, so what was the Evergreen program? The Evergreen Rehabilitation Program, the Evergreen Hospital, it's known by a lot of things, was modeled after St. Dunstan's in London, that was established to take care of its blinded veterans for World War I. The Red Cross started this program, and it was called the Red Cross Institute for the Blind. And at the request of the Army Surgeon General, the Institute was asked to work with General Hospital 7 in Baltimore, Maryland, taking in its blinded veterans. Now, this was not a hospital program. This was a rehabilitation program that mostly started by a groundswell of people, and through the Red Cross started the program that we had to do something with our disabled vets as they were coming back from World War I. Blind guys were coming back in a very large number. So this started down on Charles Street, actually, where Loyola College now is. The Women's Clubs of Baltimore assisted with some of the training and the hospitality, of course. You have to have hospitality when you're doing a rehab program. The Braille Transcribers Group in Washington, D.C. for the Red Cross in 1914, 15, 16, 17 were hand-making books for the Library of Congress. When the Evergreen program started, they exclusively went over, sending all of their material over to Evergreen, as did six other Red Cross chapters, where sighted women were turning out all kinds of Braille books. And within 2 years, they had over 1,000 volumes in their library. So what was the Evergreen program? For those people who tell me, oh, it's so hard to go to the center for 6 months and be away from my family, they wouldn't have made it at Evergreen. We had a large number of blinded vets coming in after they had spent time in hospitals overseas or in other parts of the country and had other issues dealt with and were ambulatory. They came to Evergreen. which meant also that we had some of the soldiers who fought in our armed forces. This wasn't just the Army, it was the Navy that sent their people there and everything. They had people fighting from other countries. Canada had several people fighting in our military, and so some of them didn't speak English very well. So we had this big group of people that were coming in. The Army and the Red Cross said there have to be some standards. You can't be drinking. You can't be doing bad things. You have to be respectful of others. And if you can't do that, you get out. And then they brought somebody else in. It wasn't like they had a no waiting list. There was always a waiting list to get into Evergreen. If a student had difficulty keeping up, you got to remember the soldiers came from all parts of the country. Some of them had a sixth grade education. Some of them came from prominent families. Some of them were very poor. They came from a variety of backgrounds, and some had difficulty keeping up. If they were trying, they were kept at Evergreen and extended their stay. If they weren't, they could go. Again, the Army said, you know, we don't really need you here if you don't want to be here. Everybody that was there had an option not to go. So everyone who was there was someone who wanted to be there. They had a reason for wanting to learn. And so the program was set up on basically two principles. It was enable the students to prosecute his work more successfully. That's their wording. And number two was to give him some small measure of intellectual training. In other words, the academic department attempts to give to the student mental tools for his calling. The school stressed that they were going to provide training in certain careers, but that was not the only career that they could go into. So the first part of your training was basic academic stuff. The Braille courses were to provide a Braille in the study of the code. They did drills, intensive drilling, and a lot of them were audio drills. You know, they spoke to each other. What are the dot numbers for K and so on, and what is for grade 1.5? They taught grade 1.5. That's because most of the books had been done in grade 1.5, by the way. They were taught to use the slate and stylus, the Braille writer, and what was called a Braille writing tablet, of which I really can't find a good description of, so don't ask me about that. The students were not only supposed to be able to read, but they were supposed to be able to take notes as well. The course was 6 months long. Then there was a business correspondence course. This course was to teach students how to write a good business letter. The letters had to be neat in appearance. They had to be grammatically correct. They had to be clear in content. And this meant that the class started out studying grammar and the more simple principles of composition. And then there was a study of like business languages, like what are some of the terms most commonly used in different types of business letters and so on for a variety of businesses, not just for a particular one. There was commercial arithmetic. The students were taught the fundamentals of arithmetic, and through drilling, they were taught to gain speed and accuracy in oral arithmetic. So they would be given series of numbers to either add together, to add and subtract from, to multiply in part, and they were all trained to do this in their head. They did take notes in Braille in the class, but the main focus of the class was that If you were going into business, no matter where it was going to be, you probably would not have access to a cash register that you could use. You might not have access to paper and a slate and stylus, so you better know how to do it in your head. They had English for the foreign students so that they could converse with their fellow students as well as the instructors. They had a spelling class, and this was for their vocational course as well, so there was ordinary business language involved in that. This course was 3 months in length. They had a typewriting class, and the typewriting class was broken down into two parts. The first part of the typewriting class was to gain techniques in typing, to become accurate, and to be able not only to type quickly, but to take dictation on a typewriter as well. You were allowed 3 months for this part of the class. The second part of the class was a class that was vocational typewriting and dictaphone operation. This class was also 3 months, and you were taught to get faster and faster and faster. At Evergreen, there were many military dignitaries that were there or stationed there for a time, and as part of your classwork, you would handle their correspondence as well. So that's the first part. So you have to get through that first part. Some of the people left at the first part went off and got dictaphone jobs, and Evergreen had, through its volunteers, through its women's clubs, through the Red Cross, had lots of connections, and they got several people dictaphone jobs. Now, if you weren't interested in becoming a dictaphone operator, then you would go into the vocational component of it, and there were a couple of different considerations here when they put the careers and the how they were going to train for them, putting it together. Just because you didn't go into one of the careers did not mean you wouldn't be able to take some of the classes that were offered, because, as you will see, they had a variety of different components within them. So they gave consideration to any kind of activity, employment option that a soldier wanted to go into. And if it was feasible, like he already has some experience in it, or it was what he wanted to go back home to, they would work through that. Now, they took into consideration that not every blind, that every person was going to be able to handle every component as a blind person, but that also meant how do you use readers and what do you hire people for and so on. So the first part was that. It was just looking at what the soldier wanted to do, talking to them about it, and then trying to work it into some of the other options that they were giving. The second part was to work with folks who had small capital who were going to open their own business. And this was really recommended. If you could find the capital, if your family could find the capital to start your own business, that this would be the best thing, because you could set it up your own way. You could work the system to make it work with you. The third one was to develop vocational lines of training that will offer the largest employment for blind people. And they looked at what blind people were doing. So they developed their careers through that. The classes in the career portion, which is like after you've been there a good 6 months, for many of them almost a year, were woodworking. And they had a woodworking shop, and they taught the use of many carpenter's tools. The students in their classes were building furniture, or maybe they had special things they were building for their sweethearts or their wives or whatever. If they didn't have somebody to build furniture for, too bad, you're still building furniture, and then we'll sell it in one of our stores. They were also taught the different types of lumber, what they were best used for. So there would sometimes be little lectures once, twice a week as well. They have the typical weaving class. Weaving, people would do chair caning, basket making, hammocks. And there were people that made a, blind people who made a good living as chair caners, rug weavers, and so on. So this wasn't a career that people had success in it. Then there was novelty work. This one was for people who probably were not so much interested in getting into a full-time job. Some of the people who took this class didn't have hands, which I found kind of interesting and wanted to know how that worked, because novelty work were to make useful articles made of paper, cardboard, and cloth, such as boxes, notebooks, covers, letter files, clipping files, and they used cutters and presses that you would use, many would use in a small bookbinding business. And if you wanted to go into bookbinding, this was also, you would get into the novelty ones as well and work on their bookbinding. They did some bookbinding and printing there as well, although that's printing was not one of the classes that they put together as a formal profession. There was tire vulcanizing. I had to go look that up and find out what that was, because it was brand new to me. But this is where, at the time, you were vulcanizing shop would be where you would take your tires where they had all blown up and needed to be re-put together. This was a three-month class that you would learn about the fundamentals of it and do some practicing, and you were required to take it for 3 months. Then you had full-time instruction in a shop for the next 2 months. That was off-site, but it was partially run by the Evergreen facility, depending on who was in control. And then you did practical work in a commercial shop located somewhere in a nearby garage, and they got many different shops to take in some of the guys, and you would spend 4 months in these shops, and if your work was satisfactory, then you were considered graduated. So you would spend at least 9 months in that. Then there was the vulcanizing management class. This is separate, and this was a series of talks on the operation of a vulcanizing business, covering phases of the work not taught in the shops, such as history of the tire, the cultivation and the manufacturing of rubber, the manufacturing of automobile tires, how to start a vulcanizing business, the operation and care of equipment, the handling and repair of materials, keeping track of your work, records and accounts, advice to customers, how to secure new business, and other various business method. This course was 1 hour each day for 6 weeks. And this might be, if you were thinking of starting your own business shop, you might go into this course to learn how to become a business owner and how to take care of your records. Then there was automobile repair. This is where the difference between the totals and the partials sort of started to stand out. This covered, of course, how to repair a car, the construction and the operation of vehicles, practical experience gained by repairing the cars and the trucks of the institute. They primarily were supplemented in the training also for the tire repair, but this was primarily offered to those who had sufficient vision in order to accomplish the tasks. So you had to kind of prove yourself to get into that. Then there was garage management, and this was business course that was conducted with the automobile repair course as well. And again, it went into stuff that wasn't necessarily talked about while you were working in the shop, a series of talks on covering the principles of modern gas engine operation, the combustion engine, ignition, lubrication, business problems relating to the management of a garage and a service station, garage construction and layout, care of the automobile and the handling of its accessories, and information about the trade itself. And this also was a one-hour class for 6 weeks. There was machine shop practice. Practical work was given in metal working in conjunction with automobile repair by training in the operation of the lathe, the shaper, and the drill press. Machine work was done on the automobile parts. Old parts were rebuilt. New parts were made. The work was required of all men taking the automobile repair track, and this was at least 1 month of full-time classwork. This was also given to men who wanted to go into factory work, who had been involved in factory work in the past. Cigar making. Well, look, this was back when people smoked cigars a lot. So the operation taught people the handling of the leaf, when it comes from the factory, the rolling of the finished cigars. The factory operated in accordance with the regulations of the Internal Revenue Service, this covered at least a 6 month period. You had to learn all the regulations, how to operate your own shop, whether it be a small one or a medium-sized factory. And yes, there were several blind guys who did make a living cigar making, a good living actually. In conjunction with that class was the cigar making management class, which was a series of talks given 1 hour each week for 6 weeks, and they would talk about the trends, the making of the cigar, and these classes that were like the 1 hour a week, they would have people from the industry come in and discuss the topic with the students. The next department was the poultry department. Poultry husbandry was taught, and they had an operating farm there with all these kinds of chickens and so on. So you learned how to operate a chicken farm, a poultry farm. You learned about what hens were better layers. You learned about what were better fryers. I mean, we're talking the whole end of the spectrum. And this class could last up to a year. And several of the guys who left this program went back home to their farms. A lot of them were farmers at the beginning, before they came in. They went back home to their farms. Some started up their own chicken farm. Some brought chicken farming into the family farm and made a good living for themselves and many times for other family members as well. There was a music department here, but the music department was primarily focused on personal pleasure. For those who wanted to go into music, they were turned over more to people in the community. In 1922, the school was transferred from the Red Cross to the Veterans Bureau and was called the Evergreen Training School. And the property and the program were closed in 1925. Like I said, the proof is in the pudding. It's not so much what did they do while they were there. I mean, you can house 85 guys for 2 years and everybody's happy. You got dances on Saturday nights with pretty girls coming in from the women's club. I mean, life could be really great. But what happens afterwards? I tried to find Marylanders in the people attending, and there weren't very many Marylanders there. I was kind of surprised. I found a few, and they went absolutely nowhere. They vanished into thin air. But I found one, Henry Otis Kendall. He was born in 1898, died in 1979. He became a physical therapist through their physical therapist program. And he first got a job at the General Hospital, and then at Johns Hopkins, and growing every time in his moves. He went to the University of Maryland and was head of their physical therapy department. When the polio epidemic came, he figured there were lots of ways that physical therapists could really help treat polio patients. Maryland wasn't so convinced. And actually, he married one of his employees, a sighted lady. And the two of them left for Minnesota for Sister Kenny for a couple of years, where he found people more receptive to his ideas. They had more case studies. They proved that physical therapy done with the medical profession actually helped the muscles of people with polio, and they recovered faster and better. He returned to Maryland. He and his wife were founders of the American Physical Therapy Association in 1939. He was the author of several books, including Muscles, Testing, and Function, which happens to actually still be used in physical therapy classes today. It's been revised several times. But if you are taking physical therapy classes in a university setting, you will most likely be required to read his book. Another gentleman from Baltimore was Michael Aaronson. Jaws always pronounces it Aaron Schott because it's A-A-R-O-N-S-H-O-N. He lived from 1896 to 1976. He was born in Baltimore. He went to Ohio before the war started to start training to become a rabbi. He went to the University of Cincinnati. But when the war started, he enlisted. And his family did not want him to enlist. He could have got a religious exemption. A lot of Jewish people did at that time, which caused a lot of anti-Jewish sentimentality at the time. But he decided to enlist. He went back to Evergreen when he was released from the hospital. He was blinded during the war. He spent about 9 months there finishing the basic program. Then he went back to the University of Cincinnati, and he became a rabbi. He was also one of the founding members of the Jewish Braille Institute in 1931. He was an author. He wrote several books. He wrote Broken Lights, which was a novel based on his life. He has an extensive collection in the American Jewish archives. Many of his sermons are there. The work that he did with many organizations of the blind are listed in there as well. So if you really want to research somebody, he'll be easy to research because there's so much data about him. Pardon me. One gentleman that I learned about through my research in Colorado was a man by the name of Roy Chapman. He was from Colorado here. He went to the war, was blinded in France in an explosion. He was desperately in need of a lot of medical treatment and stayed in several hospitals in Europe for several years. And then he returned to Evergreen, where he spent about a year and a half. He was one of those who had some capital. And so he went back to Colorado, to Grand Junction, and he opened a stationery store. One of his pals, Cecil Allen from Pennsylvania, came and worked in his stationery store for a year, and then he returned to Pennsylvania. Now, Roy Chapman was not a guy who really wanted to hang around blind people. He thought he did it on his own, so everybody else should too. He changed his mind after he became a state senator and started to hear about a lot of the issues regarding training in Colorado. he changed his mind. After he was unelected as state senator, he tried to run for Congress and did not win. He was appointed director of the blind services for a while, but he spent in his later years, many years as director of the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Commission. There are several other of the blind guys who went through Evergreen who not only went back to work, but actually made a mark in our society. And so when I look at Evergreen, I think, you know, they must have done something right. I thought I would give you guys time to ask some questions and so on if you were so interested.
Thank you, Peggy. That was absolutely fantastic.
I got a question.
All right. Is it Charles?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you very much. It's just a shame that whenever they closed, that things seemed to have went downhill from there. You would have thought that the people in the 40s and 50s who ran rehab in the 60s, whatever it was, they would have, tried to, learn from what that were way ahead of the Federation's time, you know. Imagine what they could have done today if they were around with that attitude.
Well, the interesting thing is, first of all, this was started by the Red Cross, who brought the ideas from Europe, because Europe had put a lot of effort into rehabilitating blind people, blind soldiers. And so it was a private venture at first. The military got soon involved because, of course, the Red Cross felt the military should be involved. Now, the history of rehabilitation in this country starts from the First World War. And we had the veterans, the beginning of the Veterans Administration starting then. And we had beginnings of rehabilitation programs starting. Now, you could rehabilitate a guy with one arm a lot faster than a blind guy. And so, although they felt that Evergreen was a success, they also felt that it took a lot of time and effort and money. And so blind guys were much harder to rehabilitate. The Army made the decision to no longer have Evergreen because, you know, the war is now over. All the rah-ha-ha had ended. And blind guys could get, the blind guys from the First World War who wanted rehab could have had their chance to get it. So that ended, and rehab was supposed to pick up the blind guys. Some states did, most did not until many years later. So that kind of gives you a little bit of an answer what happened with that.
Thank you. Ellen?
So I had two separate questions. One was, did they teach the guys any mobility skills of any kind? And then should I ask my other question now or wait for the answer and then ask the second question?
Well, they did not teach mobility yet. The cane had not been officially introduced yet as a mobility aid. Blind people were using dogs to travel, mostly their trained pets, farm dogs, and so on. But not commonly. There was no real travel training. The Second World War was when they really experimented a lot with blind guys on echolocation, because then already it was already a shame to have a cane, you know. Now, what a lot of these guys did do, though, you'll find little references in it once in a while, and if you can find a photograph, you will see that a lot of these guys carried a man's walking stick. Many of the professional men had a walking stick. Usually they were somewhere between maybe 30 inches and 40 inches high. And they were fashionable for all men to carry if you were in business. And these guys did use that and did tap and use some echolocation to get around or to see where the stairs were or, you know, find furniture that was around the office and so on.
And my second question is, do you know if Evergreen served both white and African-American soldiers?
Yes, it did. It served, if you fought in the war and were blinded, you had a chance to go to Evergreen, whether you were black or white. And to the best of my knowledge, they did not have segregated barracks. However, you don't, there's no reference as to who was black and who was white. So you have to really drill down once you can find the guys to find out if they were black or white, but there were black soldiers there.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right, I see another raised hand. Let's see if I can, 301, last number is 1892.
Debbie Brown.
Hi, Debbie, I know that.
Yeah, okay. It's just interesting that, you know, that you don't hear about blind people as much being the physical therapy that you were talking about, the physical therapist. I know that a lot of blind people were in chiropractic and physical therapy early in the century, and somehow when things get more medicalized, the professions want more respect from doctors, blind guys get out because they're so obsessed with x-rays and stuff. And I don't know, it's an interesting study for somebody who has time and energy to do and ability to find out that the more medicalized, the more visual, and to actually study to wonder where that strength is, but also some weaknesses of not being quite so multisensory with medicine.
It's kind of interesting that you mentioned that, because in researching Henry, when researching Henry, he and his wife were very much opposed of the professionalizing of the physical therapy program. They thought it was great to get a degree. They thought it was great that you learn how to do it and that you pass tests and so on. What they were not liking was the master's degree and the doctorate's degrees that were popping up, because they felt that those people were the ones that were writing the papers, writing the books, but were the furthest away from the patients. And to really understand a patient and what they were going through and the best treatment, you had to have your hands on the person's body. And they were finding that more and more of these clinics were having the people with the higher education rarely ever seeing a patient. And so Henry and his wife were quite vocal about that, that they did not like the professionalizing of the profession. So it's interesting that you say that.
Thank you, Debbie. Phone number ending in 1668. Last four numbers, 1668. All right, let's see.
Maybe not.
Well, I'm going to unmute you. All right. I've just unmuted you. You have your hand raised. 443-341-668. Oops. Sorry, let me say that again. 443-271-1668. Yep, okay. If you don't know your phone number, sorry.
Well, remarkable things, though, about the wars is they are so terrible, but they often bring about a lot of new techniques and new programs and new ideas, and Evergreen was one that did do that. So maybe we'll see something really cool come out of COVID-19.
Maybe, yeah. Okay, last chance for questions.
Aloma?
Aloma.
Peggy, did you find any indication that any blind individuals served as instructors or counselors or directors or anything in the program? And did they do any kind of like peer support or peer counseling and things like that?
They did not call anything counseling. And I suppose partly because they were all a bunch of macho men. I don't know why they didn't have any kind of questions, have any kind of counseling per se. But what they did is at first there were, in Braille, there were definitely Braille and math, there were definitely blind instructors. I don't find the names of some of the instructors for the other classes and whether or not they were blind or not. I know that they relied a lot on the community of Baltimore to not only come in and help teach, but to also bring the guys into their businesses. And the importance of that too was that when the guys left, they had references from a place they had worked as a blind guy in this profession. So they did have some, but a lot of them were military instructors.
Oh, thanks.
Okay. Somebody had with the last four numbers, 2533. All right. We'll try 443 271-1668. Okay, there's another raised hand, and I may have named it improperly. So,
Sharon,
I have your one. Hands not. You have a question, but your hand's not raised, right? I didn't name you somebody.
No,
else.
It is. Or it is. Well, it was supposed to be.
Nope. It's it is now. Okay, go ahead, Sharon.
So, Peggy, I was struck by the type of careers that they had, and I was wondering if. Were there other rehabilitation centers, and were they as progressive, you know, in terms of like garage owning and tire, whatever, and all that other stuff?
You got to remember that back in 1920, if you were an adult blind person and you went blind as an adult, your chances of getting any kind of rehabilitation was slim to none. The schools right. for the blind had already stopped bringing in adults. Well, most of them, there were a few exceptions, but by and large, most schools for the blind no longer took in anyone who was over 17, 18 years old into the program. So if you were a civilian blind guy, you didn't get this option at all. There just wasn't these options. And they took the classes from, they made the classes out of the blind people that the Red Cross had contact with. Because they were already doing brailing projects around the country and working with blind people around the country. So they had some knowledge of what blind people were doing. And that's why the Red Cross started the poultry, the furniture making, the garage, because they had already found blind guys doing those jobs.
Interesting. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, I've got a couple other raised hands. Hopefully, you'll know your phone numbers. 410-439-2533. Going once. Going twice.
I'm here, Rhonda.
Okay. All right.
It's Sandra.
Sandra, you have your hand raised. Do you have a question?
It is. It's just amazing of this program, how many people they rehabilitated and all the different, they had so many options. And I just wish they could have carried that through, you know, onto different, you know, levels. And even now, we could learn a lot from that.
Well, like I said, the program, you could get through in maybe, you know, 9 months, But
wow.
If you wanted to do the other programs, you were there for 2 years. And
wow. The
other groups of disabled vets were being rehabilitated and placed into jobs in just a matter of months. So they considered, they were glad that they got so many blind guys out there and working and contributing to their the family farm, because you got to remember we were very rural back then. So a lot of
right.
them did go back to farms. But they did feel that it was a very costly program. And so when looking at rehabilitation in 1926, 27, 28, 29, they looked at Evergreen and went, ooh, can't afford that.
Right. But now, did they ever have any instructors to teach them and train them blind skills as well as a trade?
Well, they taught them. Poultry farmers, I think, was probably their biggest success story. But they did have several that, especially through the one program where if you had some money, they would help you set up in business and you would learn accounting and management
cool.
and et cetera, et cetera.
Your business skills.
Right. You had to learn your business class. You had, and of course
right.
you already had to take the typing letters, and you already had to take the spelling
wow.
class and the grammar class, because some of these guys didn't have that, you know, they only had an eighth grade education. They may not have had that in school. So they had to bring them up higher. They wanted them all at the same level. When they finished the first part of the program, they were all at the same level. And that's why you saw a lot of dictaphone operators who were males in the 1920s, and a lot of them came through Evergreen.
Wow.
Thank you.
Okay, thank
Charles,
you.
Charles, did you have another question? I'm not sure if I may have mislabeled you. All right, Ellen.
So do you know how many people started the program and how many people graduated?
You know, I have not found an ending piece of that. I think if I were to spend a lot of time in the Library of Congress Red Cross archives, there might be some indication. While the Red Cross was operating it, they actually sent out through some publications of theirs the lists of the men who were there, the lists who graduated, the lists who didn't complete, the lists who were readmitted, and the lists of those who had gone home and were successful. That went through 1922. After that, there was nothing that came out of Evergreen as far as lists were concerned that I could find anywhere. The Red Cross was very proud of what it was doing.
Yeah.
443-271. Hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you.
You can. Wonderful. I had to get out and come back in because I couldn't get through to you before. This is Marguerite. And my question is, were there women that were rehabilitated at Evergreen or elsewhere?
No, women were not allowed to serve in the military at that time.
Really?
No, they were not officially in the military. You had to be an official soldier in the military. There were women on campus. There were women instructors. The Braille instructors were women most of the time. And, of course, if you were a married soldier, your wife could stay there if there was room in some of the quarters. And, of course, the women's clubs and the Red Cross women would come and help in a variety of things. One of the things I didn't touch on, because it wasn't necessarily part of the class, is that the Evergreens ran two stores, one in Perryville and one in Baltimore on Charles Street. And the stores sold, groceries and whatnots and gifts and items made by the folks there. It was a regular store. And the people of Evergreen, of course, utilized the store because they were living there. But the community also did as well, because they, you know, they're down on Charles Street. They're in the heart of Baltimore. And by a lot of the nice fancy houses at the time, too. So that's where these guys got their business skills as well. When they were supposed to be learning about how to manage a store, they could spend a few months managing that store or running that store or clerking in that store. How do you deal with money? How do you deal with customers? They weren't all from Evergreen. They were from the general community as well. So it wasn't a test tube type store. It was an actual store. Mm-hmm. That they ran.
Debbie?
I'm kind of curious. It seems like there was a lot of reinventing of the wheel as far as training programs for blind people. You know, World War II, they kind of had to do it all over again. And, you know, but I'm wondering if there wasn't, I thought that in my reading there had been a lot of snobbery among like the professional workers as opposed to instructors in some of these kind of veterans programs, and you know, they were trying to wing it and trying to figure out how to do this. Was there a lot of obstruction of the spreading of good information at that time?
Well, the first 5 years, because this program started in 1917, and the military was certainly there to handle the paperwork and getting the guys in and out and getting in and out of Evergreen, getting them settled at Evergreen, helping to set up the classrooms that included building buildings and things like that. But they weren't as hands-on in the instruction at first. So there didn't seem to be any problems in that regard. The military didn't take over the program officially until 1922. And then they only did it for 3 more years.
1:24 p.m.
So it doesn't appear that there was a problem. The Red Cross seemed to be the one that did all the promoting. They seemed to be the one that did a lot of the recruiting of the volunteers. They were, the Women's Club and the Red Cross were the ones that found the places for the servicemen to go and work outside of Evergreen to gain practical experiences and so on. So the military really needed hands-on people, or the boots on the ground, if you will, from the civilians that were working in the Evergreen program.
Thank you. Somebody who has the last four numbers, 1709.
She answered my question. This is Tracy.
Okay. If I could ask everybody to please, who has their hand raised but got their questions answered, because I know a couple of you are repeats, to hit *9 to lower your hand.
I tried to do that. It didn't work.
All right. Then
technology's great.
Yeah. It's, for whatever reason, Zoom is being a little finicky tonight. So I'm going to lower all of your hands, and then if you still have a question, raise it again. So go ahead and raise it again. All right. So now somebody who I have labeled as Charles, but I'm not sure if that's right. So not Ellen, the other person who just raised their hand. Who are you? Go ahead, start speaking. I'm going to unmute you. Because I clearly labeled you wrong.
Okay. I think I was unmuting myself at the same time.
Oh, Aloma.
You were, so we could be-
Aloma, you're Charles.
Yes.
Oh, you're Charles.
I love Charles. I'm happy to be Charles. Charles in charge.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Peggy, my question is, do you know how many other programs like this around that same time frame were around the country, and if this was a model for any others, or was the first, or a partner program with others like this?
To the best of my knowledge, it was the only one. There were Red Cross people that went to Utah to start a program there, and maybe one or two other states, but it never got off the ground. And I think part of the reason was is they tried to go through, especially in Utah, they tried to go through the School for the Blind, who at the time wanted control of all of the programs for the blind in the state. So, I mean, that's where they should have gone. And I think that the Red Cross wasn't quite willing, nor probably would have the military been willing to turn over total control. Mm-hmm. And also they wanted money from the states, and the states weren't willing to give it. So it was the only program.
Cool. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Ellen.
So I think on Johns Hopkins campus, there's an Evergreen House. Is there a connection with that?
I do not know that. That's something I don't know. Mm-mm. I have no idea.
Okay. All right. You stumped her.
I did. I got stumped.
Hey.
I like those stumping ones because you never know what you can turn up.
Okay. Well, last call for questions. All right. Well, Peggy, this was incredible. Thank you so much for taking time to tell us a little bit about our history, our state's history. And wow, who knew?
Well, thank you very much. And if anybody wants to be on my monthly emails, you can reach out to me at my email address, theblindhistorylady@gmail.com. That's all one word, theblindhistorylady@gmail.com. And I am self-published up on Smashwords as well. I have several books up there that I have published, some in length and some a little shorter, about other interesting blind people from around the country. And I have been giving several of these Zoom talks in the last several weeks, but they're never the same. So don't think I'm giving the same presentation to the next one.
So do you want to tell us about the one you're doing tomorrow?
I'm doing one about Ohio and Ohio's unique part in history, that is especially the School for the Blind that it played, and a few of its graduates and what they ended up doing. So,
and if we wanted to follow you and go listen to some of your Zoom talks, how would we find out where they are?
You know, I was supposed to hit the record button tonight, wasn't I?
I did record it.
Oh, you did? Well, there's one place. I know in Pennsylvania they did not record it. They forgot to. Colorado has one archived on our YouTube page, NFB of Colorado YouTube page, which I have just learned about, so I have not been there yet. Don't know about it.
I was going to tell you, Pennsylvania, they didn't have the archive up initially, but they do now.
Ah, terrific. Mm-hmm.
And what? How would we know where upcoming events? Do you
follow me? You can follow me on my email, and I email out when I am going to present. And although I'm not really good at updating my website like I should be, you also can see it up on my website, which is theblindhistorylady.com.
Okay, and so
that's how you can
address?
Find me.
One more time.
theblindhistorylady@gmail.com, all one word.
And in case you weren't sure, this is Peggy Chung, the Blind History Lady. Thank you, Peggy.
It's so nice to hear so many of the voices I remember.